So, what happens when a theater director steps into a struggling town and ignites community change through the power of shared stories? From the Center for the Study of Art and Community, this is Art is Change, the chronicle of art and social change where activist artists and cultural organizers share the skills and strategies they need to thrive as creative community leaders. Now, in a world where communities face trauma, disconnection, and invisibility, this episode explores how the ancient impulse to gather and perform stories can foster healing, agency, and real-world change. If you've ever wondered how art can truly make a difference, this conversation with Jerry Stropnicki, the internationally recognized stage director, playwright, and creative change agent, will give you a pretty good picture of what it takes. In it, we'll learn how ensemble-based, community-driven theater projects have tackled crises like the opioid epidemic and flood response with lasting impact. We'll hear firsthand how community story-making catalyzes civic empathy and even reshapes local policy as told by someone who's witnessed communities reclaim power through their own narratives. We'll also learn about the seven principles that guide ethical, effective, and deeply human community arts practice, from agency to accessibility. Part 1. Drums, Gravity, and Gravy. So I'll just begin by asking you, where are you hailing from?
Well, I'm in Danville, Pennsylvania, which is in the Susquehanna Valley. I'm an uninvited settler in the lands of the Lenalenape, the Susquehannock, and the Munchie, who each displaced one another as settler culture arrived in the Chesapeake Bay. So here I am.
And I am in the unceded lands of the Ohlone people in Alameda, California. So if you ever been stuck with a street name or a handle that represents what you're up to?
Oh, that's a hard one. Lots of them, but many are not repeatable. Story worker, instigator, revolutionary listener, community healer is one that I'm thinking about a lot these days.
Yeah, I bet you are. So what is your work in the world that adds up to all those?
To me, it's all one arc, but the last several decades, I go where I'm invited and only when I'm invited. I never parachute in anywhere. I just think that enough damage has been done by people that look like me coming in and saying, oh, I know how to fix that. So, but I get invited into communities in some stress or post-trauma, maybe after a natural disaster, maybe after a war or during a war sometimes, or places that just feel like they better get their story out or better use their story with one another, like Harlan County, Kentucky, or Tioga County, Pennsylvania. And then I work in that community.
And what happens next?
Once an invitation happens and we figure it out, to gather stories, to listen to stories, and usually make art of those stories with the people in the community that can allow them to hear each other differently and then perhaps take action. So it's a catalytic action. That's maybe why they would call me an instigator. And so, yeah, the last several decades, I've done a bunch of these. Was dragged into it by Joe Carson, but that's another story.
And that's my next question is, how did you get that way? How did you end up doing this, what I think at one time probably was thought of as marginal and esoteric and probably now has a much greater audience and expectation attached to it? Yeah.
Well, Bill, I hope it's gained some traction over these years. That's hard. Again, you ask hard questions, but that's why we're here, right?
Yeah.
I grew up outside New York City. And so I saw a lot of theater growing up. And I love theater, but it always seemed to me to not quite get to what it could do, that it reached a place sometimes of beauty, sometimes of wonder, sometimes of spectacle, amazing acting. But I always felt frustrated by it. I went to Northwestern back in the 70s. That was there at the start of the Chicago Renaissance. I sold office supplies with John Malkovich. That's how old I am.
That's truly great. Yeah, it's great.
Oh, yeah. He was a good friend, and we were both broke. And when I left Chicago to go study with Ravana Krauss, I gave him all my furniture because he couldn't afford any. But yeah, we sold pencils together. And then even while I was at Northwestern, I was reading stuff and thinking, ooh, maybe there is a better way. And with Whit McLaughlin, the New Paradise Laboratories in Philadelphia, and Jim Good and myself, we went to Europe for about 6 months. And this predates semester abroad or year abroad. I mean, we had to convince Northwestern to let us do it without dropping out. But it was also the time if you made connections with letters and through the mail, and Martha Coyne at International Theater Institute. So I got to watch Peter Brook direct at the International Center for Theater Research in Paris, and they were working on Conference of the Birds, and they were working on Timon of Athens. In Paris, we got to hang out with Jean-Louis Barrault. In Poland, we visited Wrocław and watched Polish Theater Lab at work. Mostly hung out with this guy, Zbigniew Sienkiewicz, who was part of that company. Eduardo Di Filippo, I mean, Royal Shakespeare Company. We got to hang out with all these folks and came away from that, having seen a ton of theater, that the best work was being done by resident ensembles, by ensembles that worked together over a long period of time. That didn't guarantee great work. We saw a lot of crap work in what was then called Eastern Europe, fully subsidized companies that were coasting on whatever it was. Mm-hmm. But some of the companies, oh man, they owned it, especially in Poland. And some in what was then Czechoslovakia.
Wow. A quick sidebar for anyone who's not super deep into the theater. Peter Brook, De Filippo, and Barrault, they all have front seats in the pantheon of Western theater. Well, Jerry, what a trip you were on.
Oh, yeah. And so came back with a real desire to make ensemble theater. That led us to go study with Alvina Krauss and Bloomsburg. Great and complex acting teacher. And got to study with her for the last 5 years of her life. But by then we started Bloomsburg Theater Ensemble, and we were making great work because it does work. Mm-hmm. A company and kind of in isolation because Bloomsburg is not near any city. We were all getting paid. We had health insurance. We built a theater. I mean, all this in a town of 12,000 people. We developed a language. We made terrific stuff. Good enough that we got recognized by the State Department, who sent us to tour Sub-Saharan Africa for them.
Oh, yeah. An ensemble theater company from rural Pennsylvania off to Sub-Saharan Africa. That makes sense.
And so around 1991, we were touring 7 countries in Sub-Saharan Africa. And that's where I'm getting to, because that's where this hit. Still frustrated, making great work, being recognized. In that time, we were also starting the Network of Ensemble Theaters. We were part of the groups that set that up. But nothing is more artificial than touring for the State Department. You're staying in 5-star hotels. You've got Marine guards. You're going to embassy parties. You're actually meeting heads of state. Things are different.
Yes.
And we were all white. And we're performing American theater in Zambia and Zimbabwe and Kenya and Botswana and Namibia. We couldn't perform in South Africa because the anti-apartheid boycott was ongoing. But we did go there and do workshops. But we were doing workshops in all these countries. And very quickly, I realized that I was learning far more than I was getting. And we were in Zambia, in Lusaka, doing workshops. And these artists, younger, we were pretty young men, but these guys were younger than me. And they were all guys because women could not perform in that culture. at that time, just listening to their stories, and they invited us to see their work in Chapata compound outside of Lusaka. And it was, our minders did not want us to go. Not safe. A compound is like a township in South Africa. Compound is where all the poor people live. So 40,000 people and 3 water taps, no sewer system. It was that. And we wanted to go. They wouldn't let us bring cameras or recording devices. Our Marine guards were out of uniform, but they were there. We get to the place and this red dirt circle outside the police station in this compound. And no one was there for the performance. And so these dudes say, let's drum up an audience. And they got their drums out of the van. And they started running through the compounds, jumping across the open sewers, drumming as they go. Families, kids start following them. The word gets around. By the time we got back to the circle, there was about a couple thousand people there waiting for the show to start. And the show was an HIV/AIDS play. At that time, HIV was about 35-36% infection rate in the general population. It was a big deal. And it was a farce comedy, Bill. It was a farce. Among other things, all the women were played by guys in drag, and they were going all the way with it. The play had been built from stories collected in that community. They called it Theater for Development or Theater for Social Development, related to Boal, but different.
Yeah.
Quite different. And they had a contortionist in the cast, so... And whenever they lose the audience, this guy would come out and he'd stick the lit cigarette between his toes, throw his leg over his back and smoke it. There was call and response. It was very funny. And it was about monogamy.
Wow.
It was really about monogamy, about being faithful. Because they didn't have the drugs yet. And if they didn't have the refrigeration, and if they did, it was all too expensive to bring to communities like that. And so they were doing this work. And it knocked me out. It just knocked me out. And then I find out that, well, we keep talking to these guys. Later, by the way, we got a grant from the Ford Foundation to bring several of these folks to Bloomsburg for 6 months so we could learn more from them. And we also made a play called Under African Skies that would tour Pennsylvania elementary and middle schools. That's how we got it paid for. Thank you, Ford Foundation.
Yeah.
So we were able to do that. But so where did this all come from? Well, among other things, well, most of their funding came from USAID, the Agency for International Development. And it was part of that Bush campaign to battle AIDS in Africa. And it worked. These plays were literally reducing infection rate because it was changing people's behavior.
Yeah.
And it was so much damn fun. And so that's the first time Africa changed my life. And so came back and I, you might not tell it now, but I really don't like it, talking to people, asking for their stories. At the time, I was really quite introverted, which is why I think I got into theater because I could memorize dialogue. I didn't really have to do it. I was trying to, when they were here, think of how I might translate that into an American context. And that led to creating Letters to the Editor, which was this play we made, devised from 200 years of letters to local newspapers in and around Bloomsburg. Yeah.
The Bloomsburg Theater Ensemble is now approaching its 50th season, and the company has been realizing that goal of civic engagement with original plays like Letters to the Editor. Gerard Stropnicki, one of the co-founders, asks, what could be more perfect project for a community-centered professional theater than to revisit 2 centuries of life in its hometown and honestly present the townspeople's voices found in the town's newspaper? The play was a hit in the region, and it's been performed all around the country.
That was from PBS affiliate WVIA's special program called American Dreams on the Arts and Civic Engagement in Northeastern Pennsylvania.
And holy cow, we made that play. We workshopped it for a couple of years. An ensemble can do that. When we finally showed it in its fullness, and we'd made great work in Bloomsburg, But this was the first time the audience wouldn't leave the theater.
Whoa.
They just wouldn't leave. We couldn't get them out.
Well, of course, you had something that belonged to them because it was their story.
It was their story, and it was reflecting their story. And so then I felt that power that I had felt. We had done it. We had made something. And then, you know, word gets out. We're on NPR. Scott Simon did the longest interview ever in his show with that. And then we're touring it, and Simon & Schuster approaches us to make a book, a trade paperback. Cornerstone brings us to L.A. It's all weaves. It's all weaves. We perform it at Blue Lake, at Del Arte. Later, we perform it at, like, the National Society of Newspaper Editors.
Oh.
In Washington, D.C., for editors of all the newspapers, like, in America. At a conference, Bill Clinton was going to be there, and Secretary of State Albright, and I think Shannon Lucid, the astronaut, and we were the evening's entertainment. And because for these editors, they're seeing something that they deal with every day through a light that gives a portrait. We're doing that. Joe Carson sees it because I'm working on one of her normal plays, Whispering to Horses, as her director. And we're having a great time as director playwright. And she sees that. And Bill, she literally grabbed me by the collar and says, come here. Because she was working at Swamp Gravy.
Yeah, in Colcutt. A groundbreaking community devised and presented play that literally changed the social and economic story of that town.
Colcutt, Georgia. And she felt like she needed a new director. And before long, I was her director for the last 10 years of her life, making pieces and projects. When I learned, and I was scared because I didn't know how to deal with avocational actors. Artistry was what I was trained to do through Northwestern and Alvina Krauss. And how do I deal with a peanut farmer? How do I do that? And so Touchstone Theater in Bethlehem, this was in 1999 by now, was making Steelbound with Cornerstone. Bill Rausch, Allison Carey, this gorgeous event based on Aeschylus's Prometheus Bound, looking at the closing of the Bethlehem Steel. And I called the Bills, Bill George at Touchstone and Bill Rausch at Cornerstone, who I already knew from Network of Ensemble Theaters, and said, could I come watch? And Bill Rausch, who was directing, said, no, but you can come help. And so he put me to work. And so I would just got thrown in the pond dealing with avocational actors. At the same time, my daughter was having a crisis. She said, you're into listening to people. Why don't you ever listen to me? And so we made a teen project here called Gravity Hill. We ended up doing it twice, of teen stories. The only prompt question was, what do you do in your spare time? And we promised and delivered anonymity as best we could. And it was another situation where the audience wouldn't leave the theater. As a matter of fact, after the show, there were community meetings, the Gravity Hill meetings, came up with stuff to do, skate parks, stuff like that, because there's got to be more than alcohol and booze, because the stories were largely about alcohol and drugs, getting into trouble. And we got to do those site-specific in a teen dance club, and then later at an empty mall store. I had 80,000 square feet to stage in.
So were there a lot of kids in that audience? I mean, were the kids from the community there to see that?
Yeah, and well, there were about 40 or 50 kids in the play.
Yes.
Including a garage band.
And their parents came, obviously.
And their parents and their families came.
Yeah.
And they were pretty shocked and astonished. And it was great. And it brought change. And so ended up doing a lot of this work. So for me, the impetus was born early as a kid growing up outside New York, seeing a potential in the art of performance and theater, feeling it unrealized. Going to Europe, at the same time watching Steppenwolf take their first steps, going to Africa, being inspired and then trying to make that work. And then Joe, and then John O'Neill, and then et cetera, et cetera.
It all fits together. Do you ever think of yourself as resurrecting the original seeds and intentions of the theater impulse in humans that goes back 10,000 years.
Yeah, absolutely. And some projects bring you to that. And we gather around, we gather in a circle, we might gather around a fire to share stories, and then that becomes performance. So you're very close to the beginning of it. And 20 years after that Steelbound, I got commissioned by Touchstone to do the sequel to it, which was called Prometheus Redux, and helped kick off their now annual festival Unbound that they do every year, which is a gorgeous idea of using art to fire up community.
Yeah.
A lightly curated big festival. And we used some, we had some of the same actors that were in the Steelbound originally. And we follow the story of the character Bill George played. He played Prometheus again, but now he's homeless. He's in a hospital and doing all the story work with medical people and with government and people working with the houseless. And it was an amazing way to touch that. And that happened because the steelworkers said, we need to make another play. We're different now.
Yes, of course. So do you know the play Lady Beth?
I don't.
Well, on the other side of America, they were doing the same thing in Long Beach that they were doing in your part of the world, closing a Bethlehem steel plant. Yeah, and Susan Tanner.
Really?
Yeah. Susan Tanner, following a very similar sort of verbatim theater kind of process. The plant was closed and the workers were wrecked.
Yeah.
And Susie came into that and said, we got to pick ourselves up. She was married to one of the workers, and they did that play. And they were lucky enough to cross the paths of Bruce Springsteen, who took it on the road.
Really?
Yes. Yes.
What?
Yeah.
So, I have a Bruce story.
Yeah.
When we were doing Letters, I wanted to use contemporary music. And there was a sequence about unemployment. And I wanted to use The River. I wanted to use Bruce's The River.
Of course.
And it was clear by then that this piece was going to get attention and we couldn't just use it. So I wrote to Bruce and said, can we use The River in this play? This is what we're doing. This is what the piece is. Would it be possible? And what would it cost? And we got a fax from John Landau.
Oh.
It says, the boss thinks it's a great idea. You can use it for this production whenever you do it, forever with no charge.
There you go. Wouldn't expect any less. Part two, chemistry. So I have a seminal question for you. And it's one of the questions that I ask often, because so many of the people that I talk to, they've done work like this in all disciplines with a rigor and intention, the same that you describe. And they know deep in their heart and soul what is going to happen and why. And most people who are not in this forest are, and because of the story that's been told about what art making is and what theater is, and, you know, that you visit a theater, you don't stay there for hours afterwards having arguments or conversations, right? So what was happening 10,000 years ago when Aboriginal story makers were around that ritual fire? And what is still going on with humans, with theater?
Well, a lot depends upon how you do it, the intentionality and the rigor you bring to it, but also a real understanding of Joe Carson's brother was a neuroscientist. And so that's full, it's all through Spider Speculations. The subtitle of her book is Physics and a Biophysics of Storytelling. And she goes into some pretty specific answers to that, Bill. One is that we kind of have to understand how manipulative we're being when we're making theater. And I know manipulation is an awful word. People shy away from it. But we are controlling people's breathing. We're controlling their respiration. If we want to laugh at a certain point, we structure it in such a way so everybody inhales at the same time and exhales with a laugh, yeah. Exhales with that explosion of laughter. We're also controlling their heartbeat. So if you're building suspense in a sequence, in a monologue or a letter or a scene, their heart speeds up. Now, most of the studies on this have been done putting sensors and armrests in concert halls. But in concert halls, not only does the heartbeat respond to the music, the audience largely syncs up with their heartbeat. So the same thing is happening here. Joe quotes neuroscientists pointing out that we're changing chemically inside, that the tears from the same person, the tears of grief and the tears of joy, are chemically not the same in the same human. So we're changing something. When people, after a piece about themselves with their own stories reflected, are hugging each other and crying, the chemistry has changed in them from perhaps when they walked in. And more so, there's the chemical reaction of, I think they're called neuropeptides, which are those chemical washes that we know about, the flight or fight response. Yes. Under great fear, very powerful, which is why it's in so much of our mass media.
Yes.
And all our news broadcasting now, yeah. Pretty much. News 11, breaking, everything's freaking breaking. But that is to get that response going, because it becomes addictive.
Yes.
Our cells build responders to it.
Yes.
But the same thing happens with love and joy. They're different responders. And so we fill our lives with that. We will be more responsive to that. People watch Fox News because they're addicted to it. And it's built to addict you, just like Oxy, just like any of the addictors are. So there's the biological thing that's going. I also have a way of building projects. So I'm working with Joe when she's writing all this, and we're talking about it endlessly. And I took a different tack. I thought about what it would take to make sure your projects have impact. And to be clear, I don't think the impact is the play itself. The play is the catalyst for the community to make its own impact.
Yeah.
So like in Harlan County, Kentucky, we went from the highest oxy death rate in America to the lowest in Kentucky in 8 years.
So you're going to have to, you broached that. You're going to have to tell that story, because that's a seminal story. So, Jerry, I know you've told this story a lot, so I hope you don't mind my sharing some background. You partner with the community at the literal epicenter of the opioid crisis to create a community-based theater piece that, from my understanding, became a platform for people to share their grief and hope with each other. And I know it's impossible to say this without absolute certainty, but from every indication, the impact was enormous. Community members told hard truths. Schools found a new way to address prevention and empathy, and policymakers started paying attention. Bottom line, more than just a story on the stage. Have I got that right?
Well, yeah, but the thing is, correlation is not the same as causality, and it's very hard to prove.
Oh, absolutely.
But the people there who continue to do the plays believe that's what happened.
Yes.
But we can point to the changes that occurred in the community, electing a new sheriff, changing law enforcement in the area because there was some corruption previously, beginning a drug court, churches taking on teaching people how to do job interviews, and a clothing bank that people could go to, stopping resisting talking about
it. The invisible visible.
Oh, my God. Yes. In 2004, the only time they talked about oxy was at funerals, because it was always the cause. And so the change happens over time in a place.
So the other piece of this is, certainly you go to a Broadway play, there are people that are very good at creating drama, both in design and in text. And I mean, it's extraordinary how sophisticated they can get. You have two things here that don't happen on Broadway: a story that is of and with the audience and the people on stage. And number two is, often, the people on stage and the people in the audience are kin.
They're connected in so many ways.
Part 3, 7 Lessons. You know, Jerry, your work, the journey of it, is kind of like one big school. So what have you learned?
So while Joe was working on the writing and I was being the director and later her co-writer, and because she made me learn how to do that, I came up with what I call 7A principles, by which I can help a community design a project, conduct a project, and assess a project. And the first, and this, you were just talking about this, agency. And that is the people closest to the issue are the ones that make the decisions. It's not only their story, it's their control over how their story is told. And they have to own it. Authenticity is the second. And that is discovering that as good a director as I am, I'm pretty good. I can't get a really good professional actor to play a coal miner better than a coal miner can play a coal miner. They know how to work the stuff. They know what it is. They know what the relationships are. And so authenticity.
But you trust that, which is counter to the way you were trained.
Well, you have to. Absolutely counter.
Yeah.
But it's the same thing. I wouldn't ask one of my coal miner wonderful performer actors to play Hamlet,
right,
or do a play that requires 12 different dialects. They're going to do what they're going to do. But within that sphere of what they know, their lives, who's going to do it better?
Exactly.
We don't travel to a museum to see reproductions. We want to go taste the real food. Artistry is really important. That's my third A. This is not a hierarchy. This is more like, well, you would remember this. It's more like a graphic equalizer. Whatever we bring to artistry has to be brought full bore. Everything we've learned from all that training has to come up. But understanding that artistry is going to be culturally specific. My sense of artistry and timing might not work in Uganda, as I learned as we made a play and brought it to the National Theater in Kampala. Or I once almost got killed by a bluegrass band because we had a bluegrass band in the first Higher Ground. And we're building this and we needed a break because we had a really hard moment and we're going to something comic. So I asked for a breakdown. And Orby Hunley, who wrote Down in Harlan County, he's one of the great bluegrass performers, was the band. And they did this great breakdown. And I was like, that's perfect, Orby. But can it be a little bit shorter? Maybe you could cut out the mandolin solo. I didn't know squat about bluegrass, clearly. And they about all quit.
Yes, I bet they did. Mandolin. Absolutely. I understand because, that completely.
And so then it takes humility to understand how desperately wrong
you can get. Yes, exactly.
I can get. But artistry tempered by the fact that what I know is artistry is primarily English-speaking Western European.
Yeah.
Accuracy, we better get it right. If we're talking about something that's a shared experience, we got to get it right. We can make anonymous lots of things, number of siblings, when it happened, where it happened, for family story. Mm-hmm. But if it's talking about like a flood, you better get the date right.
Yeah.
And the storm right. Then it just, if you get something important wrong, you're done.
They're going to question the whole thing. Exactly.
But if the cast, if you have a cast of 50, 80, 100 people and they have agency, they'll tell you.
Yes, they will.
You try it in rehearsal, it gets cut.
Yes.
We wouldn't say it that way. That's not how it happened. Let me tell you how it happened and everything changes. Let's see. That was accuracy. Audacity. The Greeks Aristotle talks about spectacle, which we normally see as big in Las Vegas stuff.
Yeah.
But audacity is just seeing something done in a way you've never seen it before. Having a 5-year-old girl give a monologue, that's audacious.
Yes.
Or like those wonderful folks at Mata Bizarro and Art Spot doing a piece about land loss on the bayou with the performers in boats. That's audacious.
Yes.
That's audacity. And then the audience, just knowing who your audience is, who it's for. Mm-hmm. John O'Neill always would say, who is it for and what do you want them to take away from you?
Yep, exactly.
And I can do kid shows, but I'm not going to bring that audience to my King Lear.
Right.
And last is accessibility. We're never going to build a beloved community if people are systematically left out of the space.
And every one of those violated is a deal breaker when you're in a community and even if you hadn't created seven A's out of it, they would raise their ugly head the minute that you crossed one of those lines.
And Bill, this was created because I think I screwed up on every one of them. Every one of them is a diary of my failure or our failure, and healing through it to get it done,
yeah,
to make the work happen in a way we wanted it to happen. But nothing is more fulfilling to me than to watch change happen, to watch a community come together on flood strategy that hadn't come together in 150 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's Bloomberg's story, right? Flood stories.
I mean, and watch it happen.
Kind of weather tale from Bloomsburg, where a group has taken the true stories behind the devastating floods of September 2011, as well as the stories of recovery, and turned them into a play. NewsWatch 16's Peggy Lee joins us now with their story. Peggy.
Well, Scott, the play is based on roughly 160 interviews with those affected by the floodwaters that washed out Bloomsburg. Those with the Bloomsburg Theater Ensemble say it's a way to educate, entertain, and heal.
They delivered us 6,700 trays of vegetable lasagna. Each tray could serve 10 people.
These actors are part of the latest original play at the Alvina Krauss Theater in Bloomsburg. And they're telling real stories of the hardships faced after the September floods of 2011 washed out much of the town. Written and directed by Gerard Stropnicki.
And then have the political leaders say, we want to thank you for that, because every time we had a flood before, then there were these huge arguments about what to do about it. But because of the story circles you did, hundreds of people, 80 people in the play, thousands of people seeing it, redefining Bloomsburg from Bloomsburg to Floodsburg, that this is going to happen, it's going to happen more often, understanding what the dynamics of it are through story, the debate was done.
And what you're doing, you're handing people a vehicle, a process, a practice. And the thing that to me that is most revolutionary, okay, and also as old school as you can get, is that in essence, you're not the 76 trombones.
Right.
No.
It feels that way sometimes.
Yes, I'm sure it does. But at the end of the day, the play is not the thing. It's important. It's obviously a foundation, but it's just the beginning. And once people believe that, because we've all been trained that we go into a building, there's a stage, the play happens, and then it's over, right? But in the course of making it possible for this kind of theater to happen, you have introduced people to each other in ways they have never known. There are, yes, strangers that have become the closest friends, and many of the secrets that tyrannize a community, the closely held silences that are there, are released in a way that is probably both challenging and often healing.
Exactly right.
And finally, the thing to me that is just, I don't know, makes my hair stand, that is, whatever the hell you're doing creates a critical mass. So in some circumstances, you do leave and they stay and they continue with,
correct,
the impetus and the momentum because of that thing that happens. I'm going to quote you here. The more people who know they matter, the less people fall into despair. And the less people fall into despair, the more they will find ways to be healthy with each other.
Did I say that?
Yes, you did. And that's a healing circle.
That is a healing circle. But it's also more. I was really fortunate this summer to be invited to be part of the National Institute of Directing and Ensemble Creation in Minneapolis. And it was,
yep,
a great group of people.
At Pangea.
Among the people.
Yeah.
Yeah, at Pangea and Art to Action.
Yeah.
And just fabulous people, many of whom I know you will know. But one of the people there was Lori Woolery, mm-hmm, who for 10 years has been making the public works projects happen with the Public Theater in New York in Central Park. And one of the things we talked about is that not only does the project, the play, not start when you arrive at the theater, when you're negotiating with community and building involvement and talking to the folks who run the park or talking with the folks in this church and how to get their choir, all of that is the work.
Yes.
It's not like that stuff you have to do before you get into rehearsal.
Yeah, you're making community.
All that negotiation is the work.
Absolutely.
And once, I don't know, you enter this monastery of this work, then that becomes clear. Early on, before I got dragged into this, I think I felt, oh, but you have to do all this stuff before you actually get to do the work. But no, all that stuff is it. And making something in and of community. Our world right now, well, we're in a celebrity culture where folks know, you know, what the Kardashians had for breakfast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't need to know what they had for breakfast, but you can know that.
Yes.
But what that does, it also disempowers everybody that doesn't have the spotlight on them. It makes them feel less valuable, less important, less able to make change, less capable of even adjusting their neighborhood.
Yes.
Right? And so one of these projects does is it throws that spotlight. And even if it's just a couple hundred people watching or 50 people watching, it's going to make a difference in how one views oneself.
So here's my soapbox. We live in a country that has created an iconic idea for itself. We call it democracy, but people have completely forgotten what it is or why it is or how it is. So my friend Harry Boyd, who is a democracy maven, basically says it's never, ever been anything other than a practice. It's a way of life. And if you have a country in which people look at you as though you're crazy when you say something like, let's do democracy, let's practice democracy, let's have a democratic behavior, they have no idea what you're talking about. And that's just not good. But what you're creating is not just community, but the messy process that you go through when you make these things is, in fact, the musculature and the sinew that needs to be exercised in the practice of democracy. And when people actually discover that, it's an elixir. It is energizing. It is the reason that democracy was exciting and people fought a revolutionary war for it, because they knew the difference, right? So my final question. I think we'll all agree that we are supremely challenged in this country and around the world. But that elixir, I think, is important. The practice is there. The muscles are there. The history is there. How do we introduce this into this new odd force field we're confronting?
That's my challenge. And I do know that this stuff works. It's not theoretical to me. I've watched communities alter themselves, change, because of using performance to crack open conversation and realizing we can make something pretty damn beautiful together, funny, exciting, musically great, that we can do that. But I get stymied in how to scale it up. Mm-hmm. I'm stymied there. I'm a little stuck, but I'm working. I've got a project going here in central Pennsylvania where one of the things we're doing is I'm largely doing trainings of people to do story circle, teaching John's methodology.
Yeah.
And now in central Pennsylvania, there's a couple story circles happening every week.
Yes.
That I'm not doing. I get the transcripts because I'm supposed to make a play out of it.
Yes.
But I'm very interested in how that is building in and of itself civic empathy, how that works. And maybe that can be a strategy that can be played out.
That, my friend, is the next episode. So, to be continued. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to you, listeners, for lending your ears. I'm sure you'll agree that was quite a ride from literally drumming up audiences in Zambian townships to helping a Kentucky community confront the opioid crisis with courage and creativity. Jerry's stories are a powerful reminder of what happens when community and the power of story come together with the discipline of craft and respectful intention. Here are a few things that rose up for me. First, I think we're reminded once again that theater can be a powerful tool for transformation. You know, performance isn't just about entertainment. It can be a catalyst for deep listening, healing, new ideas, and most importantly, demonstrable and sustained change. When people manifest and see their own stories in the flesh, something really shifts. Next, another reminder that the power we're talking about here is in the process. It's not just about the play, it's about everything that happens to get there. The trust built, the voices shared, the conversation sparked, and all that hard sweat and love-infused work. That's where the real magic is. And finally, I think it's important to keep in mind that community ownership is just not an option. It's the secret sauce in that elixir we were talking about. From rural Pennsylvania to Harlan County, Kentucky, Jerry shows that when people have agency over how their stories are told, the result isn't just more truthful, it's way more powerful. So before I leave, there are a couple things I wanted to note. First, most of the theater historical references that popped up in our conversation will also be referenced in our show notes with plenty of links for further exploration. I also wanted to point out that the story about the Bethlehem Steelworkers play, Lady Beth, is shared in much greater depth in our Art is Change episodes 59 and 60 and will also be linked in our show notes. Art is Change is a product of the Center for the Study of Art and Community. Our theme and soundscapes spring forth from the head, heart, and hand of the maestro Judy Munson. Our text editing is by Andre Nebbe. Our effects come from freesound.org, and our inspiration comes from the ever-present spirit of Ook 235. So until next time, stay well, do good, and spread the good word. Once again, please know this episode has been 100% human.